Chapter 25. Through the Blizzard. The journey out of Calladay was quite different from the one that the friends had taken back to the hatchery. Accompanied by a contingent of nearly 80, mostly Avendrow, but with a dozen Ulutians and a handful of Curit and Aurochs, they traveled from the lodging in Shellobel through Monach Es and into the Burrow of Arden, the garden burrow of Calladay. All the way, a dull roaring sound continued far above them, the winter wind speaking loudly, and neither the stars nor the merry dancers could be seen as a ferocious storm filled the sky with blowing snow. "We should come back here and remain for some time," Jarlaxle remarked to Caddy Bree when he first looked upon Arden, which was very different from either Shellobel or Monach Es. Few large buildings could be seen here, and none rising more than 80 feet or so. Fields dominated the view, many speckled with huge and hairy bovine beasts, which the friends immediately realized were the muskox producers of that wonderful Curit cheese. Caddy Bree nodded, understanding the sentiment, although when the wind shifted in a swirl from the open night sky far above, the bits of snow that hit her came alongside a most terrible stench. The muskox herds produced more than milk, clearly. Even before that dose of reality, Caddy Bree was nodding to be polite, and because this wasn't a discussion she now desired. Ever since she had told her story to the temporal convocation, the last parts of her address, ruminations on her family alone, had dominated her thoughts. She dearly missed her husband and daughter and couldn't wait to return to them, return to her life. Those many friends she had left behind, too. Wolfgar, Brunner, Regis, Penelope, and all the others beckoned to her. She had been eager to get out on the road for this mission, both because of a sense of duty, due to the notion that this quest might make a significant difference in the coming Menzo Barons on war, and because simply of her own desire for an adventure. A vacation of sorts from the inevitable monotony of a peaceful and settled life. Being here in this wonderful place had proven a great distraction, full of excitement. Yet still the pangs of homesickness were growing by the hour, only reinforcing to Caddy Bree the blessings of her own life. If Drisden Bree were with her, she imagined she'd feel the same as Jarlaxle and would stay here for months and learn and experience the uniqueness of Calladay. But they weren't here, which meant that if not for Dumweel, if not for her responsibility to her friends, she would have accepted whatever conditions the temporal convocation had set for her, whatever ritual they used to blur her memories of this place, and recall to the Ivy Mansion immediately following the assembly. The party moved through the ways of Arden, noting that there seemed to be proportionally more orcs and dwarves living in Arden than they had seen in the other burrows. "They are wonderful with the oxen," Emelian told her when she asked about it. "Here in Inbeshet, the Curit and the Aurochs have found lives more akin to that which they once knew and treasured. Now they have the best of their old traditions and customs, with far fewer challenges and hardships. More of both peoples live in Shellobel than in Arden, but that is mostly because Shellobel is where their ancestors, or even they, first came into Calladay, and it is easy to settle there." "How many come in each year?" Caddy Bree asked. Emelian shrugged. "Sometimes none. Sometimes one or two were found out on the ice and brought here for aid. Sometimes, as with the Ulutian village, a large group will come in all at once. Whatever the number, we have the room and welcome them as we welcomed you. This is the strength of Calladay." He flashed her a smile and a wink. "Long ago, the Aurochs showed us how to better ice the wine, freezing the grapes on the vine and stomping them while frozen to make it so much sweeter. And the Curit taught us all how to make the cheese." He pinched his cheek, which, like so many here, was a bit plumper and less angular than that of the average drow Caddy Bree had known before this place. "I thank the Curit for this, and the Aurochs for my better dancing." Caddy Bree laughed. "The Aurochs brought us the hagfish, too," he went on, "and the phlegm that has made our clothing and armor and many other items so much better. The Curit added to that Auroch work on our garments and fabrics, mixing the cured phlegm with the silk of the white spiders. You slept on a bed covered with that silk. Have you ever known a more comfortable sleep?" She couldn't say she had. She wondered, though, given the additions these other cultures had brought to Calladay, why they were so determined to deny any thought of commerce with the South, as Jarlaxle had offered. She dismissed that almost as soon as she thought of it, reminding herself of the many wars she had known in those southern lands. Up here, there was but one enemy, and from what she could tell, the skirmishes were few and far between. She thought of the hatchery they had found, though, and she hoped that the relative peace would continue for these friends she had discovered in Calladay. A couple of hours of walking brought the group to the northeastern corner of Arden, and a great wooden door set between barracks of town guards. When it was unlocked and opened, they found a second portal only a short way in, similarly sealed, and then a third and then a fourth, finally opening into a tunnel set with a marker post that read, Terramar. Land and sea? Jarl Axel said aloud, not quite catching on. This marks the spot where there is no more land beneath your feet, Emelian explained. Now we walk out upon the ice pack, and below that is the sea. That's not terrifying at all, Intrary remarked. Emelian laughed at the sarcasm. The ice pack is very thick here near the glacier, deeper than it is high. There is nothing to fear. You would have to bore down hundreds of feet to strike the water. The magical illumination in here was not colorful, just simple lines of plain light cast under the ice at the base of the side walls. The corridor ran long and tight and fairly straight, dotted with side channels every so often. At one such intersection, they came upon a group of Kurit and Avendrau loading a cart with blue ice. The mines, Emelian explained. They are very deep, and the best of the blue ice comes from that flattened and most pressed ice over the water. Of course, you must know the exact places. Too near the sea, and it is just ice, and besides, a deep miner might break through, fall under, and be lost to the living world. The Kurid know the secrets well. Most of their mines are in Bichette for the white ice and the lighter blues, but out here, there are rich blue sheets, you see? Which we all prize for their beauty and their strength. Cadibri and the others could only shake their heads in wonder. The blue ice can hold more powerful enchantments, too, he continued. You have seen Galathay's sword, which might be the finest weapon in Calladay. The tunnel continued a long way past the mines, with far fewer lights showing the way as it gradually climbed. The group camped right there in the tunnel on one relatively flat expanse, then started early after breakfast the next day. Elena spent some time with Cadibri, telling her that they would be outside very soon and offering some tips on spells she might prepare. She explained that it would take them 5 days outside the tunnels to get to the caverns below the fortress, maybe more if the storm continued to rage. "We'll be outside the glacier?" she asked. "Oh, yes. We would never allow tunnels to connect us anywhere near the Slotty, and never build tunnels large enough for frost giants. How will we shelter if not in the tunnels? We don't have mountain walls to protect us from the wind out here, and it seems as if it's getting even colder. There are more rifts along the journey, but that is why so many Aluteans came along with us," Elena said. "You will be amazed at their constructions." Off they went, and less than 2 hours later they came to a small chamber open to the sky, where the wind whistled a curious song, and they were hemmed in on all sides by a wall of ice, some 50 feet or more high on one side, and towering hundreds of feet above that all the rest of the way around. Avendrau immediately began fishing in a couple of the many bags and bundles they had brought along, taking out silken ropes and large grapnels, pitons, and spiked boots. Cadibri and the others went over to get a closer look. "You will climb?" Jarl Axel asked. "Yes, of course," said Emelian, "and set ropes up top so that the others may follow. Why not just use magic?" "We prefer to keep all that we have in case of a desperate situation," Elena answered. "But this," Jarl Axel explained. He flicked his hands, bringing a dagger into each, then brought forth his innate drow magic and began floating, hand climbing easily with the daggers. "You are a wizard?" Emelian asked, seeming quite taken aback. "He is a drow," Zack answered before Jarl Axel, who was now floating back down. "As are you. You cannot levitate?" The surrounding Avendrau stared at him as if they had no idea what he was talking about. "Now this is an interesting turn," Jarl Axel said, setting down beside them. "So it was the Fairsris all along, the barrier to the lower planes, which gave us this inner magic." "Interesting indeed," Elena remarked. "Can you summon darkness or fairy fire?" Zack asked her. "Of course, I am a priestess of..." I mean, without your divine magic, Zack clarified. Simply because you were drow. She shook her head. And what else? Emelian asked, rather sharply. Just those, Zack answered. This is unexpected. And convenient, it would seem, Emelian said. Do you think you might use these abilities to bring me up to the top of the wall? The two of us could, certainly, Jarl Axel told him. And when Emelian had gathered the needed gear, they did just that, Jarl Axel and Zack levitating and dagger-walking up the wall. They repeated the trip several times, bringing others up with more ropes, while the curate began pulling long planks from what were obviously bags of holding and assembling a large platform to secure the journey for all others. At the top of that wall was a ledge that opened perhaps twice the height of the room on the other side within a glacial rift. The wind was louder here, deafening almost, but it remained far above and only occasional gusts whipped down. Still, it was no perch to be standing upon in a northern wind at all, for it was, of course, made of ice. So the Avendrow pulled a long-rolled carpet of hagfish mucus from another bag of holding and spread it about, providing a sticky and secure footing. Clearly, it had been cut to specifically fit this spot. Take great care in your descent, Alina told Catibrian and Treri, as other Avendrow helped them into harnesses that would latch onto the ropes. You won't fall even if you slip, but with the wind you might bounce about the ice wall. Repelling down the other side of the ice wall was among the most terrifying and exhilarating experiences Catibri had ever known, akin to the first time she had used a spell of flying. And Treri, too, came down with an ear-to-ear smile, but the way he had so easily managed the rappel made Catibri realize that he was no neophyte at this activity. When have you ever climbed mountains? Catibri asked him at the bottom. I made my way in Kalimport by getting into the palaces and unconventional ways, he answered with a wry grin. What do you think of all of this? She asked him, looking around and realizing that they had a couple of rare moments just to themselves. Jarl Axel and Zachnefane were helping the Avendrow shuttle supplies, and no Caladaeans were near. All of what? They're prepared. They know the land and know how to survive well in it. It's impressive. No, that's not what I mean. What do you think of them, the Avendrow, of Caladae, of their strange ways? He shook his head. The Avendrow are what they seem. You knew that when you told them your tale, I expect. I knew it beyond a doubt when they saved Zack at Catskelchie, he answered. That is why I dared to tell my tale. I think I knew it all along, but was simply afraid to believe it. Catibri could certainly understand that sentiment. This chasm in the glacier went right and left, out of sight in the dark night. The cloud cover hung very low in the sky, stealing the starlight, the moonlight, the curtains of green and purple. Too low, Catibri thought, for the storm clouds seemed to reach down right to the top of the glacier, and it took her a few moments to sort out that it wasn't just the clouds above, but a steady and unrelenting blizzard of snow up there. Through the gloom and blowing snow to the right came a high-pitched sound, like something in between a bark and a shriek. Soon after, many figures appeared, approaching fast. Orcs, the companions realized, a dozen, and each behind a sled pulled by what they presumed to be Muktef. But no, they realized as the teams drew close, these were larger, longer, and with four legs on each side. And snarling, yipping, and nipping at each other, fierce and barely tamed. What in the nine hells? Jarl Axel said, rushing with Zack to join the two, Azudana close behind. And Treri tensed at Catibri's side, so she grabbed his hand. We're not deceived, she insisted. He relaxed a bit at least. The Bernuks, said Azudana. What is a Bernuk? Catibri asked. An Arctos Auric clan, she explained. They are Caladaeans, but many of them spend most of their time outside the glacier. They are our eyes and ears out here, on this side of Cadij. Fine friends. She started forward, but paused and seemed to be considering something. The Bernuks were the ones who found Dumwil and brought her to us, Azudana added with a smile. Fine friends, Catibri agreed. Galathay and a couple of other Avendrow, along with a pair of Curit, went out to speak to the orcs. They returned, the orcs beside them, though they left the sleds and teams safely back from the group, snarling and yipping and showing nasty fangs. Not Muktef, a dwarf remarked as she walked by the four friends. Oh, hey, but ye might want to take care not to pet the little beasties. I can see that. Might have been Mukdef once, lots of grandparents ago, at least on one side, said the diminutive fellow, a smiling chap with blue skin and tremendous white eyebrows, whose mouth seemed too wide for his face. What are they, then? Arctos vorax, said the dwarf. Vicious beasts. They are not wanting to meet, absent their Auroch masters, I tell ye, hoy hoy. They eat what they can find, they do, including each other. Catti Bree hardly registered the words, caught by the accent of this curate. She hadn't noticed it so strongly with Kanak and Kaskat, but this dwarf rolled his words like a proper battle hammer, though in the tongue of the Avendrow. Hoy hoy, Jarl Axel echoed. What about it? What's it mean? Means hoy hoy, of course. The rogue started to reply, but just shook his head and let it go at that. The storm is blowing, but we should go anyway, Galathay told them all when she returned. There's a sheltered nook a couple of miles on. We can get there at least. If we wait for the storm to end, we might be here for a 10-day. I'll get the runners, the dwarf said and rushed off. You can ride on one of the sleds if you desire, Galathay explained, or you can try a pair of runners. Before they could ask what a runner might be, the dwarf came hustling back, carrying a bundle of long, narrow planks, turned up on one end, and with straps near the middle. Skis, Catti Bree said. The three others stared at her blankly. One of the Icewind Dale tribes uses them. You wear them as shoes and slide them along, using small spears to propel you. We are fortunate, for the wind will be at our backs, Galathay said. You might need the poles to slow you more than to propel you. Come, then, if this is your choice. Alvis will fit you properly and help you learn to use them. We could just ride, Entreri said. On those? Zack replied incredulously, pointing to a Vorax team that was close to open warfare on one another, so it seemed. We have steeds, Entreri reminded him. Save them, Jarl Axel counseled. Let us slide. Ski. Alvis, the Inuga'at Kalikurit, corrected. Ye got long legs. Ye'll do well, hoy hoy. Hoy hoy, Jarl Axel replied. Going out from the rift to the open ice pack seemed to Catti Bree like leaping into a fast-flowing, roaring river. All sound was buried almost immediately under the howl of the wind, and the whipping snow, or ice crystals more likely, drummed against her back with such determination and frequency that she felt as if a swarm of large wasps was blindly flying into her. Stay close, Galathay yelled, a most unnecessary order, for it was fairly obvious that if any got separated in this blinding tempest, they'd never find their way back. Catti Bree thought of using a light spell, but quickly realized that the Avendrow weren't doing that. Elena, too, was a priestess of the Domain of Light, after all, for a reason. Off they went at an easy pace at first, but as Galathay measured the steadiness of the foreigners, she urged the Auroch lead teams to go faster and faster still. It wasn't a long time, not more than a couple of hours, but enough that it left the friends thoroughly exhausted before they pulled up into the sheltered area. The Aleutians, all of whom had chosen to ride on the sleds, rushed into action, collecting their tools from the magical packs. The others began cutting blocks from the side of the glacier and sliding them into the intended campground. The friends watched in amazement as the Aleutians and the Aurochs, who had come with the sleds, efficiently and expertly began constructing domed structures. And with all of the others supplying the building blocks, they soon had more than a dozen ready to go. Come on, then, Azadana told the friends, and she grabbed Zack by the hand and began dragging him toward one of the igloos. This one's for you four, and I'll join if you'll have me. At least five to a shelter, Galathay commands. The wind went away when they crawled in, and Elena and Emelian came in soon after, bearing large furs for bedding along with some wood and stones. They placed the wood in a depression that had been dug in the middle of the chamber, and Elena lit it. Then, as the flames took hold, the Avendrow began stripping off their outer clothing. Emelian prepared a fine supper of conjured blubber steak, and the seven sat around the circumference of the round room, enjoying each other's company. A short while later, a shout alerted them to a visitor, and Alvis crawled into the igloo. He moved over to Catti Bree. Might I be troubling yourself for a tale? He asked. A tale? You might have seen me at temporal convocation, he said. Alvis is a representative of Bichette, Elena explained. Aye, and Bascale would have tied the war if that one hadn't started the magic, the dwarf declared. Though the magic was the better thing, I've to admit. Ne'er seen that before. What tale can I offer? Caddybree said to the cheery fellow. Any about your dad and that place, what'd you call it? Gontalgrim? I and the other, the first one. Mithril Hall, she answered. Tell me, please, begged the dwarf. Can I hear too much about our kin to the south? Ne'er seen em, doubt I e'er will. But good to know they be there, you see. Hoy hoy, Caddybree answered, and the dwarf roared with delight. So she told him all about when she and her friends, well more than a century before, had found the long-lost Mithril Hall, and the shadow dragon Shimmergloom. She noticed Alvis's expression change rather dramatically when she started talking about the battles with the Duergar, and she took care to minimize those parts of the story, realizing that she was making the friendly fellow rather uncomfortable. Shame in that, he said quietly when she finished. In what? In them Duergar going down into the deep underdark, he explained. Same as the drow elves. Too low, too near the demons. Ruined them both for thousands of years. Me own family's got Duergar in the lines. So me grandy dad telled me. Caddybree couldn't help but glance at Zack and Jarlaxle at that reply. And they both had heard Alvis, she could tell. Ruined some, but not all of them, she assured Alvis.
Ah, well.
Ah, Hail, he said. You mindin' if I put meself here for a sleep? Caddybree looked at him in surprise. She was planning to ask what that greeting meant exactly, as this was the second time she had heard it, but the unexpected request buried that thought. Of course, good Alvis, Azudonna answered before Caddybree could get any clarification. The more the warmer. Hoy hoy, Alvis answered. He pulled off his heavy boots and wiggled his toes, then plopped down on his belly and buried his face in his folded arms right beside Caddybree. Before she could even sort it all out, Alvis's snores filled the igloo. She had to admit, it reminded her of home. Smiling, wondering if Alvis's choice of his bed had been noticed by the others, Caddybree glanced about in the low firelight. Her eyes widened and her smile followed when she noted Azudonna snuggled comfortably with Zack, who seemed quite content indeed. They started out the next day to great progress, for though the storm continued to rage, the wind had shifted and was now mostly blocked by the glacier. They went right past their next intended rest fissure, but turned back soon after, for the wind continued its shift, seeming like the path of the sun they had witnessed circling the top of the world. Now the wind was at their backs as they retreated to the fissure, and in there set their camp. And there they remained for several days, for they could not test those headwinds. It is just the way in the long night, Azudonna said with a shrug, and if she or any of the other Caladaeans minded this unexpected delay, they did not show it. So many things can happen, particularly out here on the ice cap, she told them, and you simply must accept that and be prepared for it and let the storm pass. So they did. They rested in their igloos, and they talked among themselves and with their new friends, and Azudonna and Zack seemed to be great friends already, and lay beside each other every night. And Treri and Jarlaxle spent most of the time with Emelian, Elena, Vessi, and Aida, and Caddybree had more than a few new friends of her own soon enough. She didn't even share an igloo with her companions from the south at this juncture, but rather with Alvis, a handful of other curate, and even a pair of orcs, a husband and wife who told her that they were the ones who had found Dumweel wandering the ice cap, or more specifically, had found her in their own igloo, where she had crawled in nearly dead. Just like the Curat, they wanted to hear her tales more than tell their own, and at first it was quite uncomfortable for Caddybree. She thought of her arguments with Drizzt and felt rather awkward now with this clear evidence of orcs who were worthy of her respect and friendship. That epiphany led her to quiet and uncomfortable musing that followed her to sleep. Questions about her goddess, about the actions of her life, about her perception of reality itself. The next day, the storm still impassable, she remained with this group and even told them of the conflicts in a land called the Silver Marches, of a war between dwarves and orcs that ended with the signing of the monumental Treaty of Garum's Gorge. And she told them honestly of how the treaty hadn't held, and war had come once more to the fall of the kingdom of Many Arrows. The orc couple seemed sad, but not too bothered, and the dwarves no less so in either case, with not a cheer among them for the victories of Mithril Hall. "It is different up here," said Ninik Bernuk, the female orc. "The land itself wants to kill you. You live because you have friends. You will need them, and they will need you. You have no room for enemies."
"Except the Slaughti and the giants?" Caddibri asked.
"Only because they make themselves so," Ninik replied. "For those of us of Kaladay, it is best to just avoid them, but sometimes we cannot."
"Like the fight where Dumwil was lost?"
"Yes," Ninik answered. "I drove one of the sled teams that brought the rescue teams to the caverns below the castle. We do not go near to that place often, of course, but we had to try to recover the captured curate. We were hoping for a stealthy rescue. What the party that entered the caverns found instead was a great fight that cost many lives."
"Here's hoping that your Jarlaxle friend helped us sort out the riddle, eh?"
Alvis remarked. Caddibri let it go at that, and asked for tales from her companions in the igloo. They were happy to provide many, particularly the orc couple, who were out on the ice cap most of the time and had some grand adventures indeed. Mostly in the summer, though, when they could find puddles and ponds of meltwater far from the glacier. Ninik told of white whales coming up several at a time, poking their heads from the water simply to watch her and her husband. She told of a seal rookery with thousands of baby seals waddling about and learning to swim. It struck Caddibri rather profoundly that while most of her stories were about battles and glory and generational conflict, those of the Curit and Aurochs were not. The stories went on and became more private discussions as one or another of the gathering drifted off, and even those gradually quieted, overcome by snores and heavy breathing as all fell asleep, Caddibri doing so without the slightest reservation about her orc and dwarf companions. The storm broke in the morning, and the caravan set off once more, moving easily through the next days until one morning, soon after their breakfast and repacking, the friends were told that there was just one more journey to get to the caverns, a short one, and most of the team would not be going farther than this campground. The Avendrau volunteers, Azudana, Emilian, Elena, Vessi, Aida, and Galathay, put on their skis and led the way. After only a couple of hours skiing along the side of the glacial wall, they turned down a narrow rift, and from there into a tunnel to the right, one low and more fitting for a human or a drow than for a giant or a slod. Any relief the four southerners might have gotten from that proved short-lived, though, for their Avendrau escort left the skis outside and entered the tunnel with weapons drawn and ready. A short way in, they came upon a small chamber, which seemed a natural hollow and nothing that had been carved out and shaped. Galathay led them in.
"This is as far as we go," she told the companions. "One last time, I must ask you to reconsider. Your friend is lost, and if you go deeper into these chambers to find her, then I believe you are lost too. You have a word of recall prepared for Kaladay?"
"I do," Caddibri assured her. "It will bring us to the signposts in Shallowbell near the inn."
"Keep it close in mind," the paladin advised.
"When we return to Kaladay, if you are not back there, then we will know that you have perished.
I hope to see you. I do not wish the perils of this place for you or for any. Follow the tunnel and stay to the right at any forks, and take no side passages left or right. When you come upon a huge chamber filled with pillars of ice, you will know that you have found the fall of Dumwil, and of so many others. I suspect you will not find her there, but if you do, it will not likely be the woman you once knew, but an overtaken. Do not feel any guilt when you destroy that monster, if you are able, for in that case it is not Dumwil, and could not again be Dumwil."
"You've told us only a bit about these monsters, the Kante and the Endivi, you call them," Artemis and Treri said brusquely. "Do you have any details to add? Perhaps like how we best fight them? What they look like, anything?"
"There isn't much more to tell," Azudana answered before Galathay could reply. "The Kanti are empty as clear ice and flow like water. You don't see them until they are upon you. That is their secret. And they flow upon you, climbing up onto you, and encase you and freeze you and suffocate you," Galathay added. "Then their magic devours you or melds with you. We cannot know because none have prevailed in a fight with them in any meaningful manner. No Avendrau has stood over a defeated Kante.
or wouldn't gain insights even if so, because its corpse is no more than water. You can destroy them with weapons, with fire, with lightning, and likely a host of other magical spells, but that is not the problem. The problem is that they come upon you quickly and overtake individuals before you realize you're under assault. Those victims become Indivi, the overtaken, not living, not dead. Not to be reasoned with, but only to be destroyed. In that event, you are left with the corpse of a friend. Use your fire, but take great care not to stir the wind god, Azudana added. When we came here and fought, we awakened Khadij. Galathe looked at the warrior and nodded, her expression one of great pain and sorrow. We were 50 in number, fully armed and prepared for battle, the paladin added. It was not a long fight. More than half were lost.
But you didn't come back after them, Zack remarked.
You should consider that truth alongside our pleas to you, that you do not go back for Dumwil, Galathe replied. We didn't come back because we had no choice but to accept the loss.
A long and uncomfortable silence hung in the air between them all.
Might I have my whistle? Jarl Axel asked, finally breaking the tension. Not this one, for I see no Mukhtef about.
Galathe shook her head. Your whistle remains in Kaladay, and if you return to us, you will be given it under the agreed conditions. And if you do not return, it will be locked away in the Siglig, in the deep libraries, where we keep magical items and books that we dare not use. I do hope you return to reclaim it.
And in that case, perhaps refuse to take it back, Emelian added.
We are leaving soon, Galathe said. Are you sure you cannot be persuaded?
We are. Just as we are grateful that you brought us here, Caddybri told her.
I fear that you would not be if you truly understood that which awaits you, the paladin soberly replied. Ride at any forks, I recall three of them, and take no side passages and enter no side chambers.
She motioned at the tunnel beyond the room and let the friends go on their way.
Zack and Intrary took the lead, turning left at the tunnel and moving down a short distance, where Jarlaxle called for a pause, and all four turned back to watch the departure of the Avendrow.
You sure about this? Intrary asked.
Of course I'm not, Jarl Axel answered. But Dumwil would prove a great prize, and we might save 10,000 lives if we can rescue her. More, it is the right thing to do.
He nodded to Zack, who drew out Kazidea and handed it to Caddybri. She took it gingerly, held it loosely in her palm, and let her mind interact with the magic of the weapon. She opened her eyes only a moment later.
I feel her. Very near, she paused. I think.
She shook her head, for the sensations through Kazidea really weren't convincing her of much at all. She'd had no experiences with any magic akin to this until Jarl Axel had brought it to her attention, not even long before when she had wielded the sword. Nor had she heard of any such feelings with others when they used Kazidea. Still, she really couldn't be certain if the sword was telling her that Dumwil was alive or dead, or worse, if Dumwil had become one of these monsters Galathe had just warned of. The whole mission, as it ever had, seemed tenuous to her at best. She gave the sword back to Zack. I have the word of recall at the ready, and I will be quick to use it, she promised.
Not too quick, Jarl Axel said. I have no desire to ski all the way from Kaladay if we have to come back.
They started away, Caddybri looking over her shoulder repeatedly the way they had come, where Azudana had lingered behind the other departing Avendrow and now stood staring at the companions. It was pretty obvious to Caddybri that Azudana, among all of their new friends, was most anxious to see the return of the southerners, particularly Zaknafane. With that cheery thought in mind, Caddybri chased after her three companions.